Ladies and gentlemen, episode 19 of Hang On To Your Hat, the Fatherhood Podcast. It's just me in the studio again as Dan is in Broome. Dan has been our roving reporter and he's getting some amazing chats with dads up in the Kimberley. So let's get this started.
Bad Daddy, you're a naughty boy.
These days, fatherhood is everywhere. You can't get away from it. Not that blokes haven't tried. If you're not a father, you've got a father. You're a son of a dad or a daughter of a bloke. But either way, being a dad is no picnic. The fear, the anger, the confusion and, well, the love, of course. Derek Myers and Dan Lee, together with their special guests, are here to share the highs and lows, the joys and the agony of being a modern dad. But most of all, to let you know that you're not alone.
Cuts to the core when he says, you're not alone, when I'm sitting here alone. I'm going to get straight to it because Dan has got a great chat for us today and I'm going to call him right now. Come on, Danny.
Derek.
Hello.
Hang on, mate. I've just got to pull over.
Okay.
Wait a sec.
Seamless technical brilliance.
Are you there?
Yeah. Oh, that's better. That's nice.
Ah, g'day. Yeah, no, I was just driving. How are you going? Is this, are we talking?
We are. We're on. I've introduced the show. We've done the bad daddy bit.
Oh, good.
And it ends with you're not alone, which kind of cut me to the core because I'm sitting here by myself.
Oh, boy. I'm going to buy your lonesome now.
Poor old me.
So I got this first conversation down, as you know.
Yep.
That we're going to tell people about today. Andrew Eagleton is a guy I met, as I say in the thing. We met camping with mutual friends. But I thought I'd just fill you in a bit with what he is actually doing at the moment, because he's catching rogue Brahman bulls in the Kimberley. On his own, and just for people listening who, and particularly people who aren't from Australia and may not have seen it, you want to look up bull catching cars or bull catching trucks, because they have a robotic arm on the side of them. So you drive alongside a bull, and the arm reaches out and goes around the neck of the bull, and then the bull goes bananas and starts dragging the truck all over the place.
Is it like a rhino? It'd be like,
it's like a rhino catcher. Oh. Exactly like those rhino catchers that you saw in those documentaries. So this guy goes out there with tranquilizer darts,
yeah,
and sort of compressed air rifle or whatever. Sneaks up on them, shoots them to keep them a bit docile with this thing, and then catches them live with this truck. And then he ships them out. And he does this on his own.
Hang on. What for?
Well, just for fun, for shits and giggles.
Oh, are you serious?
Well, I mean, he gets paid, but he's actually an air conditioning tradie.
Right.
He runs an air conditioning business in Perth, but because he has a background in trapping and crocodiles in Africa and Australia and all over the place and feral animals, he goes up and does that on his own for fun. So he's gone now. He's out in the bush for 2 weeks on his own doing that.
Bloody
and he'll come back into town with a truckload of these. These Brahmins are about 700 kilos.
How do you get them on the truck? Does he have a crane or something?
No, well, they lead them onto the truck, I suppose, they corral them. Anyway, that's the background because we didn't talk much about exactly what the bull catching involved. But these bull catching jeeps or trucks just look like something out of Mad Max.
Wow.
So, yeah. So well, he was up here with his
That's
two
fascinating.
Daughters and his
that
wife.
Gives people a bit of an insight into what's to come. Oh.
He's the most moderate adventurer I'll be speaking to. Let me assure you of that.
Fantastic. I can't wait. I can't wait to have a listen. I'm going to be listening the same time as the audience.
Right.
I listened to the very beginning. I went, oh, this is going to be good. Some good fatherhood stuff in there.
Yeah. No, he's good. And there's a little bit of background noise. I'll record it in a different location next time. Broome's actually pretty noisy, especially this time of year. There's a little bit of beeping and cars and stuff, you'll be able to understand.
That's if there wasn't, I'd put them in anyway to create that there, you know, on the out there on the road feel. The cicadas were nice. The crickets one from last time.
I really enjoyed
that grr, kind of sound.
It
felt like I felt like some kind of movie maker for Hollywood.
Yeah.
Who would deliberately put those in. You know, with, you know, sometimes they're in the Amazon jungle and you hear kookaburras. You go, what the fuck? Let's get stuck into it because this is a beauty.
Great. Okay, no worries, man.
I've dragged you into Sobrani's, back of Sobrani's gallery at near Matzo's in Broome. And this is Andrew Eagleton, who I met with some other friends camping. How you doing?
I'm good, mate. Yeah. How are you going?
I'm good. I'm good.
It's good to be here.
Before, you were saying about, we sort of jumped straight into it, talking about all the things you do in your life and how you there's plenty of room for, you know, starting things and giving away and failing, but...
Well, look, the reality is,
you know, a lot of stuff.
One of the reasons I'm in the Kimberleys is I'm very attracted to the country. Two, I have had a lot of history with crocodiles. I used to trap crocodiles for a long time and rob crocodile nests and stuff like that, live in the bush for 6 months at a time. And it was wonderful. I absolutely loved it. And then latterly I've been, you know, catching bulls out on the stations, feral bulls and those kind of things. So
tranquilizer.
Yeah, tranquilizers tactic. Predominantly and catching arms on bull buggies. And it's to get rid of feral, nasty animals, not just to catch animals for the fun of it. It's all part of a very necessary program. You know, we were successful at both those ventures and it's been, you know, a wonderful experience. But, you know, from a more in line with this conversation, I think you've got to give your kids those same wide range of experiences and all the successes in the world don't mean anything if you're not a success with your family. And your family more so with your new family, not with your old family. That's optional. You know, how you get on with your parents or whatever, that's something different.
Right.
How you get on with your present family and how you prepare and propel your kids into this life is the one success that you have to get right.
Yeah. I mean, you can, as people do up this way a lot, you know, you can do all sorts of things and give it a crack. You can have a go at it up here and try your hand at all sorts of stuff. It doesn't work. It doesn't matter so much. But, yeah, with your kids, you kind of want to get that right.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not like a pet or something. If you didn't get it right, you can give it away. Or, you know, you can't say, oh, my child's a chronic alcoholic, but that's his fault and, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, whatever you decide in your life is you know, you just got to do the best you can. That's not to guarantee that you will get the result you were hoping for. Each child's different. Some are really strong. Even in the same family, children are so incredibly different.
But it's a responsibility you want to dedicate yourself to properly. I mean, you said to me before parenting of being a father goes on forever. It never ends. And you said if you do it properly,
Yeah, that's right.
And that's a good point, you know.
Well, I think the last thing you want is to say, look, I put in the best 20 years for my son, but I've never seen him. He moved to New Zealand and I've never heard from him again. It's like, well, you might not have got it right, you know, for him to have completely blanked you. And I don't judge those who've had that relationship. You know, there's so many factors that come into play. I think the point I'm making is for me and me only.
Yeah.
And the view I'm sharing is that I believe that you can put in your best effort for the 20, 25 years and, you know, what happens after that is their life. And hopefully you get a return and a rewarding return on your investment, your time investment.
Yeah, totally. My brother said that too, that you get what you put into it.
Yeah,
parenting,
sure.
And he sees... It's just as simple as that, you know. It's almost about, it doesn't even really matter what you do with them in a way, especially boys and fathers. You just need to be around.
Yeah.
And quality time will just kind of happen. But trying to just squeeze lots of things into little amounts of time, it's a basic equation. And not everyone can do that.
No, 100%.
Easily. And that's fine too. But, I think Derek used to. Have I forgotten it?
Oh, you were just reminding me that he does a thing. I hope I'm pinching his story here, but he does this thing with his wife. You know, the cat's in the cradle.
Yeah.
Well. Right. Which is the kind of the nightmare of all fathers, I suppose, is that your kids grow up and just don't
just
want to
like
spend
you.
Time with you, just like you.
Yeah.
You didn't spend time with them when you were young.
Yeah.
And so he fucks around and teases his wife. Like whenever they are doing something they perceive as neglectful,
yeah,
the other will start singing Cats in the Cradle
at them.
so we were going to have a section in this podcast called The Cats in the Cradle that were, you know, to address people, fathers' fears of when they may have done that. Like lots of dads, fuck, man, it's hard because you've got – often people have to work incredible hours and they have to be away, and we're going to get a lot of – air traffic and stuff here.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. And so it makes it hard. But, I mean, obviously you do what you can. And intention counts.
Absolutely.
Kids know when you at least – it's like quality time. It's not like you can't measure it.
Sure.
But they know if you are, that you want to be with them.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. I think that one of the things, the issues is, you know, parenting is almost something to do because you had sex with someone. And – then now you've got a kid, you know, like, and that kid is a genuine human being that needs so much time, energy, and investment. And parenting is an autopilot thing. There's very little training. There's very little prerequisite, you know, and you think, oh, well, I did this and I did that when I was 15, so that's okay. Look, I turned out all right. That's not actually correct.
No.
Because what you're doing is your beliefs are limiting what your family can do. And yes, you might have driven drunk 1,000 times and got away with it, would you encourage your child to do that?
No,
you wouldn't. And, you know, I remember I worked away all the time. I was away way too much and it was wrong. And I eventually, and I mean eventually, I realized.
Yeah.
And the more time you're there, quality time is not taking your kids to the movie and watching something that you're both totally distracted with, but you happen to be eating, you know, chocolate peanuts and sitting next to each other. That's not quality time. Quality time is walking at the river or going on a long drive and actually listening to their perspective and not using it as here's my chance to interject with my opinion or this little training exercise I can quickly squeeze in here.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, just let them talk. If they're in grade three, they're talking about grade three things. That if they're in high school, you're going, cringe, you're watching Love Island? Oh, my God, how could you do that? Love Island's important to them at this stage in their life to look at what dysfunction actually can be. You know, it doesn't matter how beautiful you are or how smart you are or what your sport prowess is. That's not life.
No, and someone, and it might have been Steve Bidulph, or someone was saying that it's actually important that that you're kind of doing nothing with them sometimes or what's – because it's that thing of saying it shows that they're worth being with, when there's not a reason. Because, you know, often it's that tendency when you're very busy to try and make good times happen, important, or as you said, like force a lesson, not force a lesson, but kind of encourage some kind of learning, trying to make multiple things happen at once. But just if you're just willing to be there, again, it's fucking hard with being busy and,
You definitely have to put some time aside, some conscious time. So with my family, which my wife instigated, wasn't me, we go out once a week, no matter what, for family dinner.
Right.
Each person gets to choose which restaurant we go to, and no one else can complain about that restaurant. If you don't like Chinese food but one of the kids has chosen Chinese food, that's where you're going, and just zip it.
Yeah.
You know, if sometimes you have to tolerate a vegetarian meal and that's not what your preference is, so what?
It's good exercise in diplomacy.
100%.
For life.
And you don't invite other people. You don't bring someone else's friend. We had a day of the week. Ours was Thursday. It is flexible by negotiation. If something important is coming up or if there's a school function or something that you can't get out of.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's a commitment. And it's a commitment anyway. You can't just say, don't worry about it this week. We're all too busy. You go to Tuesday night if you can't do Thursday night. The amount of pleasure we get out of that is insane. The amount of talking and listening that we get to come across, my two daughters chat between them, a lot on those evenings, which is a beautiful thing. You wouldn't even chat in that same space at home. And we just sit there. Often we're just listening. Sometimes we're talking. It's a really pleasant way. And my kids look forward to family dinner night every week.
Yeah, because you are making a thing of it, an event of it. And there's something about committing to anything that gives it value.
Yeah,
very inherently.
Much so.
I mean, I found that when I came up to Broome and because it was the first time I came up here to quit drinking, as I've told you about, and I'd been in Melbourne very socially removed. I used it, drinking and stuff, as a way to socialise. You know?
Sure.
Basically sort of socially anxious. But then when I got up here sober, I had to commit myself to certain things socially, not just like it's easy to commit to a job or to whatever, but go to change your value system and go, it's important that I show up to this person on this day mm-hmm. and then treat it like you would if it was a job.
Yeah, sure.
Like with the same level of importance.
Yeah.
And then that's how I started to redevelop my social skills without booze up here by just going, you know, no matter what, I'm going to go to this fucking meeting or this whatever, or I'm going to help someone do their garden or whatever it was, just to make that commitment.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, that's also a very interesting point that you raised, because Australians generally are very heavily reliant on alcohol for socialising, and I'm in that category.
Yeah.
I've drunk all my life and I've liked it. It's been a good friend of mine for a long time. And then all of a sudden you're feeling the wheelie bin every 2 weeks. You can hardly move it with empty wine bottles and stuff like that.
Mm.
And it's got to start you thinking, I don't want my children doing that.
Yeah.
So I was talking to my daughter on this trip, and we're actually talking about what you can do when you're out there enjoying life, ex alcohol. Why is so much socializing alcohol related?
Mm.
When you go to someone's house, when you go to a birthday, when kids go out and socialize outside the house, they're probably not down at the river doing this or that, with some exception, of course, don't get me wrong, but you go to the pub or the club or the nightclub or...
Well, it's the greatest known cure for anxiety.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, it immediately it takes it away. It gives it
temporarily
back tenfold
later. Kick the can down the road a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Till you can't communicate with people. Well,
but you have to learn to do it. You have to learn. And like you taking them out.
Yep.
This comes back all the time. Within whatever limitations you have, the more you can try and take kids out to, the bush or to space or...
Yep.
They don't even ask for the phone or the iPad when they're out there.
No, 100%.
And then, they learn some stuff that maybe they won't need quite as much booze or drugs.
Well, it's funny because on this trip, one of them said, my life in Perth is actually quite boring. I'm not utilising it properly.
Yeah.
I am socialising too much with the same people and with alcohol and so on and so forth. So it's nice for people just to know there are options.
Yes.
There are other things. Don't say Perth's boring, let's go to Melbourne. There's just more pubs and restaurants in Melbourne. It's what you are or what you're feeling at the time that you've got to transcend. And if Perth's boring, you're probably not looking in the right place for your stimulation.
Yeah.
So you're blaming an outside factor.
Yeah, yeah. See, I for me, being coming to Broome initially meant that it was a small enough community that it was like training wheels for me before I went back to Melbourne, to be without my medication and learning to socialise. At least I think I said it like Broome small enough to fit in my head without bursting it at the seams. Whereas I felt very overwhelmed back home.
Yeah. Yep.
So there's a good opportunity to do that up here. And of course, get out.
Get away.
Yeah, get away.
Change your colours.
So, hey, tell us a little bit, because the great thing about for me coming up here all the time is I always meet people. Everyone's got a story about everyone who's got a connection to the Kimberley who wasn't here originally. So anyone who's not Aboriginal, basically, has got some story, it seems like, and you were, you hunted crocodiles?
Initially, I was trapping. So very different from hunting.
Right.
In that everything I got was kept alive and was relocated to breeding farms.
Right.
And it was a little political at the time.
Yeah.
There was a enormous increase in crocodile numbers.
Yeah.
There was increasing number of deaths in this area, because this is in Africa that I was doing it.
Ah, right.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is in your 20s or something.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Very early, where you have absolutely no fear. People thought I was incredibly brave. but they didn't realise the distinction between stupidity and bravery yeah. is a very thin line. And
well, they
fortunately,
send kids to war,
100%,
yeah.
and absolutely fearless. So I did. I had a wonderful time there. I really enjoyed it. And all our crocodiles went to breeding farms, which is good. We don't kill them. And we had to remove them from a situation where they were definitely going to get shot because they were hanging around near boat ramps. Yeah. A 17-year-old guy got killed with a croc coming up to him and launching the boat and just pulled him under, which would be devastating for everybody. A African policeman was bathing at the river, grabbed him on the head and pulled him in.
Jesus.
And blah, blah, blah. People go all the time over there because they stand waist deep fishing
yeah,
for right. dinner. Literally, not for fun. They're yeah. trying to get something to eat tonight.
Yeah.
And a croc just picks one off, one off, one off, one off. Easy pickings for the crocs. And because yeah. of the changed environment, because it was a dammed river,
yeah.
and their ability to increase in numbers dramatically and incredibly quickly, it was becoming a problem. So, yeah, we got a contract, two contracts, one to rob the crocodile nests. So we used to lift all the eggs from the nests in
oh,
the
okay.
bush.
To keep the numbers down, you just simply
well,
take
that
eggs
was
and then
to
you can use the eggs.
Commercial farming. That went yeah. to commercial farming, but you were removing numbers from the bush with a promise that you had to keep 1% of your hatchlings for returning to the bush where required.
Right.
Which
I think they did that here as well, didn't they? Like,
certainly we were talking about. I don't know what they returned yeah. here or did or didn't.
Right, right.
But that was wild harvest and yeah. then trapping the crocs. To send them back to breeding farms. And it's so much better. Even living on a breeding farm is going to be so much better than living for 80 or 100 years and getting a bullet in the head because
yeah.
you happen to be living in your natural environment and it's not convenient for human
yeah.
beings.
You
know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, we ship him into the farm. So I did that for a couple of years over in Africa, two egg collecting season and one trapping season.
But was this before or after you were – a tradie before you were in air conditioning?
No, I completed my apprenticeship.
Yeah. Then went over there.
Well, then I went to sea for a year to work on the fishing boat. So five heron addicts and I went to sea for a year and worked
Sounds
on the
like
fishing boats.
A joke. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Then I went to Africa after that and I only went travelling. You know, I was travelling by myself, but I met some wonderful people over there, some absolutely fantastic people that are still like another family to me now.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so they were wonderful and just branched out from there, you know. So that's when
you
I got into the crocodiles.
But then you did it here as well in NT or something, didn't you?
I did some shooting here, but
right.
shooting's not really my cup of tea. I just don't
yeah.
I don't like shooting. I like trapping.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so much – well, it's a better end result for me.
Right,
like,
sure.
You know, I understand the stealth and the hunting and stuff, but the end result's pretty unattractive for me personally.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm attracted to the hunting right up until the point at which you have to put a bullet in something's head I when I think it through.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
love all that. I think it does appeal to something, at least in men. Well, you know, I'm making a big assumption, but for most men that I talk to, there's a desire to kind of get out and pitch yourself against
yeah, yeah.
the beast and in the wilderness and be out in the countryside. But you're sort of doing that with catching bulls but without having to actually kill them.
Yeah, that's 100%.
So, yeah.
And, you know, for me, if I had a contract to shoot bulls, I wouldn't do it. I have no interest
no.
in ending it that way. Mm. Not that I'm criticising those that do.
Yeah, yeah.
For me personally, I'm happy to trap them. I'm happy to trap them all week long and return them to their owners. What their owners do with them is not my business.
So you're being – it's the being out there.
100% being
out
there.
Being out there, following an animal.
Yep.
You know, kind of figuring out the game, the plan, the strategy.
Yeah, and you learn a lot from those animals just because
yeah.
you have to have a lot of patience.
Yeah.
You just wait and wait and wait and you observe. And patience is not my strong suit, never has been. So it's something I've had to work on and I enjoy it. But not only the bulls give you the reason to be there. So that's great. That's your goal. That's what you have gone and travelled and bought equipment and, you know, beaten yourself up to get out there and your vehicles to get out there. But what you haven't counted on is the immersion. And the immersion for me is as good as the bulls because, for example, I had forgotten how quiet life can be. How amazingly quiet it is when it's 45 degrees. Even the birds are quiet. There's not a fly around, nothing. Everything is quiet except this gentle breeze in the trees. So all you can hear is the leaves rustling.
Mm.
Or occasionally, if you're near a river, you might hear this little plop where a fish jumped to get away from another fish or or something disturbed him or whatever he does, whatever he's there's no phone, there's no person, there's no helicopter, there's no truck, there's no boom gate. The reward I get from that, it's like you just feel something melting off you. It's like petrol evaporating. It just goes away. All this tension just goes away and you start coming back to who you are as a core human being.
I can feel all the people in the city, all the blokes in the city just salivating at this idea. Because I do. I just, it's so romantic to me. It's just, especially when you've got kids too. The idea of spending a few months out there doing that. I don't know if I could do it. I mean, I don't know if I could cope with that kind of isolation, but it certainly appeals to me. And because, and to get, or just, as you say, let it slide off and get connected with the ground and the and nature.
I think it is something that you have to grow into. You can't come from a busy life and go to a stopped life instantly.
Right, yeah.
But it, and for the first 4 days of any holiday, I'm useless, often sick, you know, often unwinding from this moderately uninteresting, high-stress existence I have when I'm earning money and running a business and getting paid 120 days later and, you know, skinning through this and diving out of that and arguing with people on site because the people, the managers and supervisors aren't what they used to be and builders aren't what they used to be, et cetera. And I'm kind of old school. I just still like stuff done properly and whatever. So I can't just go to the bush and relax. So anyone who thinks they can just go from their busy life to that life and get on straight away is probably not being realistic. And so anyone in the city who you think that may fit is definitely don't go and book a campsite and go, oh, that was shit. The dunnies are terrible. The kids were annoying.
Yeah, I think that's where I fucked it up because I, when I was in Broome, before the kids and the family and all that stuff, I bought a troopie, like a camper troopie, and I thought I'm going to go out in the bush by myself. I'm going to go out in the desert or camping, just go wherever on my own. And I went for one night out somewhere miles from anyone, and I was in this camper on my own and I totally couldn't cope with it.
Yeah, right.
But I think it was that thing that I just had this huge expectation and I just threw myself straight in that deep end. I mean, I hadn't even been camping out there with other people yet.
Gotcha.
You know what I mean? So I think I didn't do myself any favours.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And it can be overwhelming, especially if you're going solo. Like not going to a campground by yourself, but I mean going bush. Going bush by yourself. Bush. A lot of stuff out there, a lot of spirits and stuff, whatever it is out there. And what I find is really effective is you do small trips by yourself and you drink tea.
Yeah.
And then when you finish that tea, you have a cup of tea. Another one, you know, you don't have to be hiking 30 kilometres.
Yeah, I think just
one
just
of the big advantages is you go to one place and you sit there and you be quiet and you just listen. Yeah. You don't listen to music and who cares if the dockers are losing again. You should be used to that by now.
Yeah.
If you're, don't take alcohol with you. You can, of course, if you want to. If you feel better sitting there with a beer in your hand just listening, that's great. But don't talk, don't think, don't make a phone call. Just sit. And automatically you'll watch that bush come alive.
Yeah.
And it might be come alive with thoughts, but often where I am, it'll come alive with animals that have gone stony still because you've turned up. And they're either watching you or they're not letting you know where they are. But once you've sat there for a while, they go, oh, don't worry about him. He's fine. And then they hop off to do whatever they do. And you go, oh, shit, there were some wallabies over there that I hadn't even seen. Yeah. And look at the birds and listen to that. You know, that's amazing all of a sudden. So you don't have to dive in too deep and you can pack up and nick off home again because you're not so far away. And I've taken other people out there. Where one place in the bush that I was working on a site, they said, oh, this place is a shithole. I said, boys, that's not fair. This is not a shithole. You're just not looking in the right place. And I said, grab some beers, come with me, and we'll go out this afternoon. And we jumped into the car. I drove about 50 k's away and I said exactly what I said to you. Just go and sit somewhere. Don't talk. Don't listen. Don't communicate with anyone. Just do it. Well, I ran into one of those guys the other day. It's about 6 years ago we did that.
Yeah.
He still remembers that day of sitting in the bush quietly by himself and how rewarding and wonderful it was.
Yeah, and you and that thing of waiting because it's all happening.
Yeah.
You know, there's some big profound metaphor in that, isn't there? Like it reminds me of the Pascal philosopher, his quote about all humanity's problems stem from man's inability to sit quietly alone in a room.
Yeah, okay.
You know, to just be there. And then and all that, if you can deal with that thing, then everything will start to move and come into place.
Yeah, bit by bit.
That's exciting.
And don't expect too much taking your kids out either.
No.
Don't think they're not going to want to see everything or they're going to want their machines because they're used to using iPads and getting fed stuff. Or they don't want to read a bloody book because it's too slow when they can watch a DVD or you know, not even a DVD nowadays. They can get instant whatever access to the rest of the planet or the avatars and
you, were stuff. Because, see, I've seen a photo of you with a massive crocodile with when in the, what appeared to be the 70s because you had a haircut like it was. Either that or it was the 80s. I'm not sure how old you are. But you had one of the kids, you had a baby with you, so they must have been going on some of these trips since the beginning, since the early days.
That's true. Kate came with us. That was an accidental shooting trip, to be honest with you. We were shooting.
Huge fucking crocodile head.
That was massive. That was probably one of the biggest crocs in Australia at that time. And he measured out to about 19 feet in the old language.
Jesus.
And, you know, it's pretty hard to do an accurate measurement, so allow for all the exaggeration you want. I don't care. It was over 16, all right?
Well, the bloody head on its own looked as big as you. You were sort of crouched down next to it.
And it comes up to my temple.
Yeah.
And even standing up, it goes from the ground to my hip bone to the back of its jaw. That was just his head. And I felt terrible about shooting that croc. That's the honest truth. I'll never shoot a croc again based on that. That's why I thought, you know what, I want to start my own crocodile retirement home. Right. Where all those big old boys that are causing trouble, that are killing beef and just doing what they do but are becoming a menace for a human, or they're in water holes that people are drinking from or town water supply they have to be removed, they can come and live with me. I'll be happy with that. Just have my own farm where they can live.
That's kind of what Malcolm did, didn't he?
To an extent. Malcolm also had a commercial side to his farm.
Yeah.
Sure. And good luck. I don't criticise that, but that's not quite where I was thinking of being. Yeah. It's a retirement village that people can come and chuck a couple of shekels in the container so we keep them all fed and happy.
So those big ones that have been biting outboard motors and
they can live out their
those
life.
Those crazy ones that are going to – they're just going to get dispatched if not retired.
But keep in mind how hard it is for a crocodile to get to that size. It defies all odds for a croc to get that. Like 1% of the nest survives. So – to get to be a breeder, you are top of the animal kingdom.
Yeah.
You know, you've lived through the battles. You were clever enough to get away from the bigger crocs that were going to eat you. You managed to navigate all the other predators, the starvation, the lack of water, the currents that you're living in, the monsoon range that wash everything away. You've navigated all the way through that life and you're now a breeder. That's like a fraction of a percent can actually achieve that. And if you know, blokes come along with a high-powered rifle and bloody put a bullet in your coconut because you ate their dog or something. It's just not.
Yeah.
It's not cricket, really. No. I just think it's not a it's not a fair result. Like chopping down a massive old tree because you want to put a fence line there. Move your fence line a meter.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
If rural, maybe not.
I remember this crocodile out at. Because Jonesy, who will be on this podcast soon, who obviously is your mate as well, who was the manager of the Malcolm's Crocodile Park before Malcolm died, bizarrely, or it might have been Will who worked there as well. Like a couple of my mates have come up here chasing Malcolm Douglas in their youth, as did I. The first time I came to Broome was largely because as a kid, I'd watched those documentaries, Malcolm's documentaries, and at the end of the documentary, he'd always say, "And the sun's setting and now it's time to head back home to Broome." And I'd be like, wow, Broome must be unbelievable. And so I always kept that in mind and then finally got here. And then Broome just changed my life.
Yeah, sure.
And I don't know if that was just that spiritual anticipation from when I was a kid or whether it's Broome. I mean, everyone talks about Broome's magical powers like it's really uncanny but anyway was it? Oh that's right, the crocodile, because this thing about crocodiles and their ability to just sit there and wait and he said that one of those old fellas, because I was looking at it not moving us, you can sit there and behind the wire and look at them and their eye does, you're looking right into their pupil and you're trying to get them to react. And there's nothing going on. And Will or Jonesy was saying that one of them was there for a year or something. Didn't eat. Didn't do anything.
More.
Just sat there. And this is what they can do. They can sit there with their mouth open and slow their metabolism so much that their only job is to snap their jaw shut. That's the only thing they have to do in incredible pressure. And or maybe it was Malcolm that actually got, but they got used to this crocodile.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day it launched at one of them. Because it'd been a year or something. It was something absurd. I don't know. But it just in terms of that sort of, like, crocodiles are still working on geological time. You know?
Sure, sure.
Like, that's like a second in.
Oh,
that's,
yeah,
that's
absolutely.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, looking into that eye, I've never looked into anything colder.
Yeah.
Anything less emotional. And I've been mighty close to a lot of crocs. And like you say, the ones on the other side of the fence, I think it gives you a beautiful little window into 165 million years.
Yeah.
Goes back into that eye.
Yeah.
Because they haven't changed much since the original guys. And
all of that strength and power is like a coiled spring, all for that one purpose of one explosive moment to get food, which might be once a year or whatever. And the whole thing's for that, you know. That's breathtaking, isn't it?
Yeah.
And basic, you know, biological purpose.
100%. It's one of the reasons they've been an incredible success up till humans have really started knocking them around.
Yeah, yeah.
They were a total success for all those years for several reasons. One, because they can lay a batch of eggs that they don't have to mother.
Yeah.
So that's a great thing. They only have to eat a couple of times a year, so that's a great thing. They can live on land and in water, so that's great. Yeah. You know, they when everything else is dying because of a drought, that works for them. You know,
of course.
They can live on that. So, you know, their ability to reinvent themselves and come back strongly is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Providing they don't get shot out and their eggs get eaten and they get tangled in fishing nets.
All right. So in light of the fact that you have done a lot of different stuff in your life and traveled around a lot and not particularly patient, you suggested, and, you know, you just, you, like a lot of the guys I know up here, pretty into real experiences and changing your experiences. What was it like when you had the kids? And just like, did you, first of all, was it something you totally thought about and anticipated? And then also, how did you kind of cope? What was the adjustment like?
Well, look, it was, we planned to have kids.
Yeah.
Definitely. There were no accidents. It was planned. We were in a reasonable financial position. We'd been together for 5 years, so we were quite stable as far as relationship goes.
Yeah.
We're at an age where it was sort of age appropriate now to be having kids, et cetera. So there was a level of planning.
Mm.
But I don't care how well you plan. You are not ready for what's going to happen to you.
Yeah.
And it used to annoy me when people, you know, when you're pregnant, you go, you know, my wife was pregnant and they'd roll their eyes and go, oh, you're about to, you know, you're about to join the parents club. And it used to annoy me because we elected to do it. We wanted to do it. We knew we wanted to do it, everything. And I used to call them the eye rollers club. It used to annoy me, like, you know, there's them and us.
Yeah, yeah.
And, oh, have you made a mistake? It is undoubtedly the best thing that's ever happened.
Yeah.
But the reality is it was frightening.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially in the early days. You are tired beyond tired. Your wife is tired 1,000 times more than you are. There's all sorts of coping mechanisms designed in humans to manage, but your sleep deprivation, your fear, your lack of knowledge, your anxiety is all in complete and utter overdrive. When you bring this little tiny creature home, you can't even see if they're breathing. You've got your ear down next to their nose because you haven't heard anything for a while and you just want to make sure they're still alive.
So no matter how good you are at stalking crocodiles for weeks on end on no sleep, this is something else, right?
Oh, 100%.
I mean,
it's a
whole
new
world. Like you said, the responsibility, this is the job you can't afford to fuck up. You really don't want to fuck up for many reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got the weight of all that.
Yep.
You've got the weight of the eye rollers.
Yep.
Because that does affect you in some way or other. It's like all these bloody parenting books that exist now.
Yeah,
it's
sure,
like,
sure.
You know.
Well, that's just a two-dimensional view.
Yeah.
And although it's done with the best of intentions and everything, it doesn't always translate to you.
No.
And especially when you're so tired or, you know, you're still working or, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you're raising kids by yourself nowadays. You know, grandparents will come in and give you a hand or someone will drop a lasagna over.
Mm.
But I think if everyone knew how difficult it was in those early days, you'd all be dropping lasagnas over. You drop a week's worth off.
Yeah.
And you take a kid for an hour or take your other kid, you know, the family's other kid for an hour or two
yeah.
just to give someone or you say, look, I'll do your shopping for you.
Yeah.
what do you want? Or give me a list or I'll buy what I think you want, whatever it is, because I don't believe anybody knows what is heading towards them.
No, except, you know, I wonder about, like, I spent a lot of time in Vietnam and places like that, and you look at the families all living together by necessity, you know, probably, and when culturally. I mean, we've, through sort of wealth and all that, have been able to separate ourselves from extended family. And I don't want to live with all my extended family.
Yeah, sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And people in Vietnam might neither if they had the choice. But the advantage of it, it seems to me, is that there's some passing on of knowledge and experience and just...
Yeah, I agree.
Like you've got, like, even before you have kids, there's kids around and
there's
grandparents around. There's all this stuff. And I feel like at some point we all here in the Western world are going to have to move back toward that.
Well, that'd be a really positive thing.
Somehow. Yeah.
Because even
kids
up
need
here,
to see grandparents or different age perspectives.
Yep. And bigger nieces and nephews carrying around kids on their hips.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're getting experience earlier than I used to work with the Orang Asli over in Malaysia. Mm. And it used to blow me away how they never cried. They never pulled each other's hair. They never had that aggression. They might chuck thongs at each other and play catchy and that sort of stuff.
Mm.
The only crying you would hear is when someone fell over and hurt themselves, not because he was being mean or she said that or, you know, whatever. And it was. Yeah. We've got a very isolated system of growing your family.
Yeah. And, you know, you hear Luna's been having a few night wakes lately, right? And, you know, there's that screaming because she's 10 months. So there's that screaming they do where you know they're going to go back to sleep. They've just kind of woken up and they're, no, it's not. But then there's the terrified, that scream that's really, it strikes you.
Yeah.
And you can't, you just can't let it go.
Yeah, that's a panic.
Yeah, it seems panicked and it's wavering. And we were the other night, the problem we have with her is as soon as you go in and you try to comfort her, it doesn't comfort her, it makes her worse.
Oh.
And then she's less likely to go to sleep. The only time, but then occasionally if you take her and actually take her in the lounge room, turn the lights on, give her half an hour of actually, like, snap her out of it.
Yeah, gotcha.
Then put her back, she'll grumble and go back to sleep. But the point is, I wonder about, because we're told to just leave them. Or, because what the fuck do you do? You know, like, if we go in, we're going to make it worse. if we stay out here, I cannot physically, I said to Missy the other night, I can't physically sit here and listen to that.
Yeah, sure.
Because it sounds like she's terrified.
Yeah.
And I'm just not fucking doing it. I don't care if we don't sleep, you know. But there's all this thing about training, like when you see other cultures who just it's like, and just having them around. I mean, you're all just dealing with each other all the time. But then you can't operate the kind of lifestyle we do and do that.
No, absolutely.
You know what I mean? So we're kind of stuck. But I think they are terrified. I think we do, you know, I wonder what damage we're doing to them. Oh, yeah, you can't worry about what damage. I mean, that's what parents do, don't they?
Sure.
What damage are we doing?
Yeah, I'm sure there'll be plenty of times when your kids think you're a horrible person and that you're too controlling and you're bloody awful and you did this wrong and that wrong, and I think you've got to forgive yourself a bit of that. But you also have to accept that some of that's true. I've done things that I wish I hadn't have done.
Yeah.
And I've been in situations where I thought it's entirely justified, but looking back, it wasn't the right situation or the right way to handle a situation and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Other cultures, like I was working in Africa for a long time, those kids are on your back being carried around all the time. They sleep next to you, you know, the whole lot. That's total immersion parenting, and you're working, you're planting crops by hand with a kid on your back. You know, there's no dropping them off at the nanny or whatever. Other cultures have a nanny from – like, I know people, not just cultures, that have had a nanny since the time their kid was 6 weeks old, and that's fine, you know, when you're working and stuff, but some of them aren't working. Some of them are living their social life.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe that's the way they were raised. Some kids get packed up and sent to boarding school at 6 years old. For me, I couldn't do that. I love my kids. They love their kids too. Don't get me wrong. There's no criticism on those people. For me, as a human being, and what I love about life, I've had all these adventures in my life and lots more than we're talking about today. But the biggest adventure and the best adventure I have ever had is my children, my two girls who I love and adore. And there's times they hate me and there's times I'm going, this is bullshit. I can't stand this. I want to get away.
Mm.
the best thing that's ever happened in my life is those children.
Because that's teaching you shit, isn't it, man?
100%. I mean,
there's someone, again, I can't remember who it was, there's so much conversation happens up here. It might have been Will or Jonesy said that there's in at least one of the local Indigenous groups use the words for, like they call their daughter mother and their son father because they're the ones doing the teaching. In a way.
Oh, how interesting.
Like the mother has, they've brought the mother into the world to kind of show them themselves.
Yeah, right, a reflection.
And yeah, like, and if you are willing to accept that that's the case, that you are going to be constantly presented with an opportunity to grow and learn and develop, then you might, maybe it won't be necessarily easier, but you're going to be able to perhaps not get into resentment or feel trapped as much.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's a very valid point.
Embrace the thing that's happening.
Same deal with a friend of mine, one of those guys. You know, I was having a bit of a grizzle one time about my folks, something they'd done or hadn't done or whatever, nothing too major, I might add, but they – and Jonesy, it was, said to me, oh, Andrew, you're here to teach your parents. And it struck me such a flip of what you sort of expect, which I guess as a parent you sort of have this air of – arrogance that you're here to teach your kids how to navigate through life, which is certainly true to an extent, but at least 50% of this journey is you learning, you seeing your parents differently because, you know.
And learning to fucking humble yourself.
You're not going to get it all right.
Yeah. So suddenly that line, that cliched sort of line that kids used to say, I didn't ask to be born.
Yeah.
It's suddenly a legitimate thing to say.
Absolutely.
Your kid says to you, look, I didn't ask to be born. Then you have to go, yeah, well, good point. You're just here. I did it. You know, like they can legitimately say to you, well, what did you propose to get out of this? Yeah, I mean, what were you expecting to get out of this?
Yeah, and you can't say, well, look, I had you because you got to teach me some stuff.
Yeah. Actually, maybe I should try that. I'll spin it around and actually say that.
Well, it may empower your child to see things differently from a much earlier age. So you're here to teach me stuff, and they may just embrace that.
And some kids are more clearly looking after their parents. I mean, I've got friends whose parents were so dysfunctional that they were literally – looking after the family and doing all the sort of adult things.
Yeah, right.
So, and I feel like, I mean, I don't know the details of those parents, but and everyone has different issues, but I think some parents just haven't been willing to go on that journey as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, like just dictating to the kids what to do, and it sort of doesn't.
Well, I think you miss something pretty important in dictating to your kids and thinking that you know everything. Your parents didn't know everything. You're living proof of that.
Yeah.
So why should you know everything? And it doesn't matter how many books you read or if you've got three Jags in the driveway and a view of the ocean, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean you know what you're doing. You might be an extremely good dentist or something like that, but it doesn't mean you've got the time, effort, skills, strategies, whatever, to have brought up two or three or seven well-balanced children that are going out into the world to try and live a functional life.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, sure, they might get a good job or apprenticeship or go to uni. That's awesome. My kid did this and my kid did that. Are they completely strong within themselves? Are they taking substance because it's a nice little escapism for half an hour? Are they doing too much mattress time because you are never there for them and they're looking for some kind of affirmation from other people that they can never get, they can never achieve. I work with people, men, intelligent men that are better at my trade than me, who keep getting attracted to these people, bosses, that will not give them what they need. And what they're looking for is compliments, love, acceptance, because they didn't get it.
Yeah.
They didn't get it from where they should have got it. Therefore, they're looking for something that they can probably never get.
Yeah. It's and then on top of all that, they're entirely their own brain and mind, and you have limited influence over that too.
100%.
Like certain stuff, you can just, you meet them, you don't make them.
yeah,
sort of thing. It seems like with a lot of Indigenous cultures too, that there's one way of doing it.
Yeah,
we have all these multitudinous ways we can parent, which goes in line very well with consumerism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our freedom, our perceived freedom, is in choices for white goods and how we choose to parent. I'm this kind of parent, or I'm that kind of parent.
Yeah, pigeonhole it,
and I do it this way, and I do it that way, and.
But there's also, if you look at it, these indigenous cultures had a goal in their early days. It was to survive. You survived better if you were a mob.
Yeah.
You didn't have a Game Boy. You didn't have sport on the weekend. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You couldn't fly overseas to go to Oktoberfest.
Yeah.
You had to do this, and there were a certain set of rules that have been handed down for a long time, often for control, often for fear, but often for survival of the group.
Well, and it's worked that way for a long time. Look at Aboriginal cultures here that have possibly been here for 60,000 years and are relatively, at least, you know, in obvious ways, unchanged. Mm-hmm. So they've had a long time to see that a certain way works.
Yep.
Like we've had the Industrial Revolution and we've changed away from nature, for example. So all of the parameters have shifted very, very, very quickly. And I'm sure things changed over time in Aboriginal life in the Kimberley, but not like that. So they would have had thousands of years to kind of gently hone what's needed to keep the group safe and, you know, and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know how we can ever go back to that.
Well, I don't know that you can.
I think that, you know.
I doubt you can, you know, short of Armageddon or, you know, nuclear... Yeah. Something or other that you have to go back to, you know, trying to scrape a living out of a rock pool or growing a few veggies or harvesting whatever you can do.
It's sort of unsustainable the way we do it, though.
100% of people could not survive that.
We can't keep going like this. Like I've got this recurring image that eventually Aboriginal Australia is going to be back to being Aboriginal Australia, and everyone else will be gone.
Well, I don't know if that can ever happen, to be honest with you.
I've got this thing in my head it's all out of the bag, obviously, unless people were untouched by...
Sure. You might find a few untouched mobs in the Amazon or super deep in Papua New Guinea or something like that. But, you know,
but they're the only ones that could withstand on a geological time frame.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, it feels like... Well, and all these sort of civilizations that become empires and cities and stuff...
Mm-hmm. And keep in mind,
a limited lifespan.
They do. You tell me one that survived.
Yeah.
None.
None.
Not a single one. You know, humans have, as a species, an amazing ability to adapt and change and take out our enemies over a period of time. So we've done very well as a species, but not one civilization has built up into this massive thing. You know, Mongols and, you know, they're around for 150 years total. Dominance of their area and then poof, gone.
It's a trade-off then. Technology, sort of all these choices that come with, like, cities, I suppose, and stuff. It just, you know, you can't sustain. Because we're still biologically, I mean, we're still animals. We've still got a fucking crocodile brain underneath all this stuff.
Well, what does surprise me about most of the civilizations that grew, they all... went away from nature. They started controlling nature first by harvesting all the trees for firewood and building and blah, blah, blah. And they harvest all the food and then they start growing their own food. Like there's some amazing examples in Mexico, for example, where they had these amazing canal systems, self-fertilizing they called them, because all their human waste was used as fertilizer and it worked this fantastic system for... So more people came from rural and lived in the city and more people came from rural and lived in the city, and then all of a sudden there's no food. And you can see it by the bones. Their small bones are deformed from a lack of nutrition and stuff like that.
Right.
So then it's the gods are being cranky. So we've got to sacrifice more people to the gods to appease them. There's weird sort of human construct of what we need to do to get the gods back on side. But once you tax your environment too heavily, it will capitulate at some point.
Yeah.
And we're lucky in Australia because we've got a massive environment and you have tons of options. How many cultures overseas can you just go and start a cafe, or can you go to TAFE, or can you get a refrigeration apprenticeship, or do whatever? There's not that many. There's a lot of people in Europe that are totally unemployed. They got better brains than I have. They got, you know, whatever they need, but they just don't have the opportunities.
That's exactly what, and there's an Italian backpacker I was talking to the other day, and I said to her, why do you keep coming back to Australia? Like, what is it really?
Mm.
And she said, I could narrow it down to, you're allowed to do whatever you want here, or you have the opportunity to try anything.
Yeah, sure.
So as you said, you can start a cafe, you can do all that stuff. And I hadn't even thought of that. She said, it's very, very hard to step out of and just do something else, to go and catch bulls.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to, you know, whatever you studied in school is what you go to.
Sure.
Boom, boom, boom. It's hard to get even an opportunity to try something else.
Yeah,
I hadn't even thought of that. But we are, especially in the Kimberley Cross, when I moved up here, you find yourself in jobs you're not qualified for a start, because like someone doesn't show up or they couldn't get someone and they give you a go. It's crazy.
Yeah, and a huge drifting population. Like the Italian one's a very interesting one, because I believe recently they were, you know, uni graduates were talking about not what job they're going to work at, it's what country they're going to work in.
Yeah.
Because it's shut down. You know, had 9 recessions in the last 13 years. Like, you know, fair go, guys. How are you getting out of that? It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So your greatest export is now brains and people that are heading off overseas.
Oh, yeah.
So we are so incredibly lucky. Talking to an Italian guy down on a jetty, and he was saying, mate, you guys have no idea what you've got here.
Mm.
This is the best place on earth. We were in Perth at the time, and he was saying you can swim 100 metres off the beach and get a crayfish on your capital city. You've got work opportunities, you've got job opportunities, you've got study opportunities, you don't have to have a surname, you don't have to have big amounts of money. And the reality is, you all want to go to Europe and have a look at our bent castles, you know, and a little painting that you stand in a queue for hours to go and see at the Louvre.
Mm. But and most of the time we don't want to stay.
Some
people do. I mean, creatively there's always been a bit of a pull to other countries like that for me, and like either America or Europe, just because Australia's so difficult on that front.
Yeah.
It's just not the audience. But
yes, of course.
But we take a lot for granted. So have you made just in sort of coming to the end, but have you made really conscious decisions a lot about getting the kids up here and appreciating that stuff?
Oh, absolutely.
We've
been taking kids camping since we were little. Some of our trips have been too hard and have gone backwards.
Right.
We've actually discouraged them.
Yeah.
We've taken them overseas, but when I take them overseas, it's not a spoilt trip at all. It's like we go and find the beggars, you know, and to see this is what life is in other parts of the world, you know, and especially in parts of the world that you would think, like the amount of homeless people in Paris, and London and stuff like that. It's not all shopping malls and wonderful life and beautiful food. There's a real hard side to all this. And
that's what shocked me in America. Fucking hell.
Unbelievable.
America's
a vicious system.
And it's disintegrating.
Yeah.
Apart from Rodeo Drive and a couple of other places, the footpaths are crumbling. That's what LA seemed to me. And it just homeless people. But then the weird thing of the homeless people being so jolly, because they all think they're going to be millionaires in 3 weeks.
Head to
Vegas.
They just
need a good turn of luck. And I was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, so, it's a difficult system.
Yeah.
So we've tried to broaden their horizons, we definitely fight any elitism ideas, because we're living in a pretty good suburb in Perth, one of the better suburbs. There's enormous amount of wealth around us.
Yeah.
You know, people just drift off to Japan for a ski trip for Christmas holidays, you know, 30, 40 grand later, come home. Like, that's not my cup of tea. We try and steer our kids away from that to some extent.
Yeah.
And just keep them grounded. When we go to Indonesia, we go to Bali. My eldest daughter's raised a lot of money for the Bali Eye. So she managed to get enough money to pay for the repairs for 75 blind children to get their eyesight repaired.
Wow.
So that's phenomenal. So we're giving, you know, they have a social conscience.
If kids can get if they can start to see the value personally, even just how that makes them feel to do things like that. That's going to change their wiring as they grow up.
Absolutely. You know, it's not just about you.
Yeah, and it's not quite the same instant dopamine hit that, you know, that buying something is, but it's longer lasting.
Absolutely. And you know you've made a genuine positive effect on another human being's life for the rest of their life. You've given a blind person, a blind child, real legitimate options for the rest of their life. If that same child becomes a teenage mother or, you know, whatever, that's their choice. That's their life. At least they can see now. They can work now. They're not a burden on their family now. Mm. You know, the a lot of black magic up there and, you know, like gods have made them blind for a reason and so on, so they can never get married. Mm. You know, there's so many things. So, yeah, that was a really, really powerful effect. Mm. That was through the John Fawcett Foundation, I know. 95% of your money that you raise goes to an eye recipient. And that's very important for us, that it all goes to the people. And we went up there and we witnessed the operations. And we met the first girl that got operated on.
Oh, wow.
Those are life-changing events. I'll tell you now, it changed me too. Mm. My daughter and I, just us, went together. It was hard to get organized. Garuda, to their credit, ended up giving her a free flight up there because she'd done such an amazing job. Mm. And we were really well looked after up there. It was just amazing. Mm. Those things change your kid's life. And they change your life as well.
I keep coming back in to Missy's dad, Chris, who were talking about surmounting obstacles with your kids of some sort. It's not just holidays on the beach. But he and his son go on climb mountains on a regular basis together.
Great.
So, I mean, it doesn't really matter what the obstacle is. It's the time they spend both together kind of putting, solving something or getting, doing something like that together, a challenge.
Well,
and it's a similar thing, I suppose.
That's such a perfect thing because it ties into this conversation about being a parent. That's awesome that works for them.
Yeah.
I wanted my kids to be on the Gibb River Road this week with me.
Yeah.
Rattling their ass off in the dust, the broken radio, the this and that.
Yeah.
And it didn't work. And I was annoyed. I wanted them there with me. I wanted to show them this beauty that I can see, et cetera. And they didn't. They had other things going on in their life that was a priority for them. And I didn't push it. I was disappointed.
Yeah.
It didn't work. But you know what? It will next year.
Yeah, yeah.
Or it will the year after. So they're not always on call for you as a parent because you want to share this with them today.
Yeah.
This is what I want and this is what we got to do.
That's a hard one, actually. It's a hard one to really recognize what they want.
Absolutely.
Especially mine are very young, so it's even harder. So I'm just offering them things all the time. But yeah, you often want to, you want to make them in your image a
bit.
Absolutely.
I want to share this beauty with you.
Which is understandable.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, then also finding a way to let them come to it, you know.
Yeah, well, you get them to the edge. If they want to jump or they want to step back, that's okay.
Mm.
There's another year. Gibb River Road, those rocks have been there for a couple of million years. We can't fly past 10 minutes later, get the sticker at the other end saying, I've done the Gibb River Road or something, and miss the whole essence of what it's about. There's nothing worse than taking grumpy little people out there that do not want to be there. Then it's not a good trip for everyone.
There's been a lot of disastrous camping trip stories.
Oh yeah,
on this podcast, my brother's told a few.
Yeah,
and again, because he's wanted to go out there and have this experience, he's wanted too much to have this experience. And then the funny thing is that it becomes a funny story then after the fact. So
100%.
You kind of can't lose, really.
Well, that one,
it's better to try.
The really bad camping trip is the one they'll remember fondly forever.
Yeah, because once the scars have healed.
Yeah,
then it becomes a funny story.
Yeah, that's right.
And did you find you had to make really conscious time for you and Annette during their upbringing?
Yeah,
I found this with the second kid. We're like, shit, we could easily lose our sort of connection with each other.
100%. And you know what? Didn't do it nearly enough.
Yeah.
And it's a big regret of mine because when you enter a relationship, it's you.
Mm.
You're the entire pie.
Mm.
Then you go in with a partner and now you're half a pie and you just keep subdividing that per kid. And all of a sudden you're just a fraction of what you were.
Especially if you're old when you have kids. I find
it
even more difficult to kind of – even if you want it, it's not a matter of just wanting it. You've got to
– and pre-program it. And there's times in your life where it's impossible or right. so close to impossible. Mm. It's just ridiculous. So in instances like that, and I didn't do this. I'm not parent of the year by a very long stretch, very, very long stretch. Having said that, I think, you know, you would do well to buy them a present if you can't do this. Or certainly you want your few brownie points, do the dishwasher, hang out the washing, do all this stuff that they're drudging around doing. It must be absolute torture to be sitting at home with kids that shit themselves all the time, that demand your attention.
This is, of course, for those who are in a family where the mother is at home looking after the kids.
Yep. And dad's working, which is sort of the Australian model.
Yeah.
And, of course, it works the other way around. And that's a totally separate topic, which I have some ideas on, and why it's not as accepted as it should be or could be.
Doing what you can to recognize each other.
Give them a break.
Because you just don't recognize each other after a while.
100%. And you're different people.
Yeah.
You're stressed with work. She's stressed with home. Yeah. When you get home, you clash. You're both tired. Kids are still annoying the shit out of you. You think she gets it easy because she's going to the park with the kids to push around on the swings hall. You're working your ass off. She thinks he's gone to work. I'd far rather be going to work and doing what I do in a structured thing, and if I need a coffee, I can go and have one.
Yeah.
So everyone thinks the other person got a good deal.
Yeah, yeah.
And it builds up anger and resentment.
I think that's where we're a bit lucky too on that front because we just split it according to whose work is demanding.
Yeah, sure.
If I've got a play to work on, which is less often than, I mean, Missy's mainly doing the stuff, so her, you know, when she's touring and all that stuff, then I become much more primary carer, and it flicks around. So I think that we're lucky with that because we don't end up, because lots of people talk about that dynamic, the grass is greener dynamic, and some of that comes from just being in the same bloody, you know, there's disadvantages of staying in one role
for
a long time anyway,
and it builds up resentment over a long period of time.
It definitely does,
and even if it's the only option, it still breeds resentment.
Do you feel like with them being in their late teens now?
Like
almost kind of.
Yeah, getting to the edge of the nest.
In terms of, so are you able to do more together?
Yeah, very much so. There's times in your life where you just go, it was like
after
your first 7 years, finally you might actually get a night's sleep, a full night's sleep.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember when I had friends round, it took years, and I mean years, before we completed a single conversation.
Oh, yeah.
Where you just keep getting disturbed. And then my mate, went and got pregnant. It's like, oh, I can't believe you guys. We're not going to be able to talk a conversation through ever again.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I know, it's funny, isn't it? And you watch people who don't have kids trying to deal with you, trying to talk to you while you've got the kid there, and and they just, it's so strange. And then what shits me is the kid will be going, Mum, 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 or Dad, 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 while we're trying to talk. And then you'll finally go, yes, tell us what you want. And then he goes, do you like blue or something? You know, he's just trying to, you just don't want us to talk. I don't want you to talk. Just says it straight.
Just got your attention.
Yeah.
I know. And the other person that doesn't have kids takes that as very rude. Like, and I do and did. When you're in mid-conversation with someone, the kid comes up and goes, Dad, can I? And they stop talking to you instantly and they talk to the kid and say, yes, of course, okay. So, and they come back and say, sorry, where were we? It's like, oh, Jesus. You know? Exactly. But what a demand.
It's like parents who, when I was, because I was childless and thought I would be forever up until I was 42 or something. But that thing, that smarmy parent thing of, look, you're talking about some triviality in your life, some concern like your shoes didn't fit you right and you're going to have to take them back, or you were up late at a nightclub or something, and they've got that look on their face like your life is just pointless. It doesn't mean anything. It's like you don't know anything.
Yeah,
and it's so irritating because my life is important. And then when you have kids, and you can't help it, but you look at single friends and the sort of things that concern them, and you do you notice that smarmy grin going on in your own face? You're like, fuck, I'm doing it. What am I doing?
There's a love you have with children that you could never explain. Love,
yeah.
You know, you love your dog, you love your job, you love your partner, blah, blah, blah. You love. There is no love like the love of a child, both giving and receiving.
Yeah, it's scary. It's kind of at certain times it can be overwhelming and scary because it's that, because you're suddenly so vulnerable because of that.
Yep.
You know, like when you have the horrible thoughts about them dying or something, you know, it's something else.
It also gives you a perspective. All of a sudden you've got these little people, you can't just go and die either.
Right.
I used to enjoy spearfishing, and some of my spearfishing was in some heavy-duty water.
Yeah.
Like good stuff. Where
great white shark.
Great water. White, but also more so crocodile water.
Oh, right.
Yeah, you know, sure. And stuff where we knew there were crocodiles. You know, we knew there's crocs in this water. We don't know if they're here or somewhere else, but you knew. Wasn't particularly comfortable diving either, I might add. We didn't have to dive. It's not like we sunk the boat. We were spearfishing.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, if you've got family, you go, well, hang on. Can I afford to die here and let my two daughters navigate life without their dad for the next 20 years or whatever?
Mm.
And that's a pretty selfish sort of way of looking at it. You know, you can't afford to die and let your kids just look after themselves.
The best example of that is Richard Bradley, who's another Broome person who will be on this podcast in subsequent episodes. But because he's a fucking lunatic, as you know, and he's base jumping.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, he had the wings, the bat wing base jumping that he used to do, along with, what's it called, that, you know, diving at the bottom of the North Sea. What's it called, you know?
Saturation diver.
Yeah. You know, he's serious done crazy stuff. But so when they had their first kid, there was a very serious discussion between the two of them, and he sold his bat wings on eBay. Because, you know the ones I mean,
what,
right?
How much did you get from?
I don't know. But, you know, he said something like 50% of his base jumping mates are dead now.
Wow.
Like they all die. On a long enough timeline, all die.
Sure.
And so it was like, you're not base jumping anymore.
Yeah, you know? And that's a fair comment, isn't it?
And he went, yeah. And he's not saturation diving anymore either.
Sure.
Because he's bent enough.
Yeah, gotcha. Well, I think a lot of this stuff, and even if you're earning really good money saturation diving, you know what? Great. You paid your house off 10 years earlier, or you do a lot of trips overseas or whatever, and no criticism, that's awesome. That's what you should be doing. You should be investing every cent of that really sensibly.
Mm.
But what is the trade-off at some point?
Yeah, it's
dangerous. Do you die down there?
Yeah.
And how important is that extra 50 grand when you're not coming home?
For people listening, this is when you dive at such depth, usually to work on gas and oil pipelines or whatever, but it's diving at such depth that you have to have a different air composition. So they have a lot of helium, don't they, and stuff like that. So this mate, Richard, used to call me from the bottom of the fucking North Sea or wherever he was, or the shelf off here, and he'd be like, oh, g'day, Dan. How are you doing? Oh, this is Dingo here. And then you'd hear another big butch guy behind him go, get off the fucking phone, Dingo. What are you doing? You know, like, and they're in this tiny bell diving. Yeah. He calls it the can. For God knows how long, three big muscly guys.
Yeah.
28. Talking at
like 28 that. Days at a time, you're underwater.
Yeah.
And your only privacy is the dunny. Or you have a little curtain to pull across your bunk, and there's someone sleeping above you as well. You got no room, mate.
And then they can't bring you up quick. You've got to come up stage very, very, very slowly.
Yeah.
That is like my ultimate claustrophobic nightmare. You cannot get out even if you wanted to.
No, 100%.
Even a fucking plane, a commercial airliner, I can theoretically at least open the door and fling myself out into the abyss. You can't even do that down there.
You're squashed.
Fuck,
you can't get up, and you're heavily reliant on other people for your life.
Yeah.
They got to bring you up properly, and particularly in the case of an injury,
missing part of his brain, that's what's
well, or the longer you're down there.
He's got more, I don't know, something.
I don't think we're designed to be down there too long breathing mixed oxygens and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a trade you probably want to give up at some point.
At some point, yeah. Well, so he'll have some stories. I won't talk about them because I know he'll tell them. But, all right, I reckon that's probably that's it. We've chatted for an hour. It's great. It feels like you could just talk for...
Absolutely. Like, and it is the most important thing in your life.
Yeah.
Nothing else is important. Yeah. The job, the career. What's a career? Jesus, what a joke, you know. And I know you've got to exercise your brain in something that that you really enjoy. But, you know, this idea of being able to just give them money or take them on good trips or something is not not the answer.
I'm struggling with that a bit because I've defined myself so much by my creative work throughout my life. And I also couldn't really achieve most of it because I was drunk for fucking 20 years. So sure. I just couldn't get any, I had all this potential that was unfulfilled. So I finally have the sobriety and the kind of space in a way to start completing things.
Yeah.
Finishing plays, books, doing my stuff. And I've got a family starting at the very same time. So I'm torn between the two, because so I have to really try and let go. I love them and I want to be as present to them as possible, but so much of my self is defined by this pursuit of my creative life too, so it's hard to jump between the two. It's like another child.
And you can't helicopter parent and be there for every damn second. You can't make every decision for them.
Yeah.
But I think if you have the intent, that's the most important part. And secondly, maybe you can look at your creative spirit as you've created a couple of living sculptures that have to be crafted all their way through their life to being the best human they can be, whatever that is.
We had the bonsai guy on a few weeks ago. And I was trying to draw parallels between bonsai and kids. And it's that thing of, you know, you start on, it's a long-term thing, and you can't push them beyond their, it's not pure sculpture. You've got to sort of support the nature of the tree and the nature of the children. You can't just force them, but
can't help feeling that bonsai might be for a more controlling parent.
Well, that's right. Exactly.
I couldn't do it. I think I'm more bush than bonsai.
I'm bonsai fanatical. But I don't know why. We don't know why that happens.
It will get easier the longer you're in it. There's various stages where it's all encompassing, then a bit less and a bit less, then you will finish a conversation, then you will be able to go out.
Yes.
Well, one time both girls are out at school or something, you go, do you want to get dinner? And so you go out and you have dinner and a glass of wine, and that's something you haven't done with just the two of you for 10 years.
And suddenly you value that experience much more than you did before. Absolutely. So,
and the babysitter is worth the money.
Get
someone in every now and then to go, you know what, yes, I know it's going to cost me some bucks, but it doesn't matter.
And it's crazy, as we started with it, the very start of the conversation, saying about how you're thrown into it, it's the most important job that you really want to try not to fuck up, and you don't want to have to try and do it too many times, but there's no one can ever train you for it. It's totally a moving, a groundless scenario.
Yeah.
So you just got to kind of surrender to it and try and enjoy it.
Yep,
and I hope they don't pack you off into a nursing home too before it's necessary.
I'm sure with Jonesy, Richard, myself, chances of getting to a nursing home not that good.
Yeah.
You never know.
Yeah, out there, bones in the Kimberley.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, all right. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks for coming in. Nice running into you.
Awesome Podcast was recorded at Castaway Studios in Collingwood. Here, we provide affordable, accessible, professional podcasting production facilities to the full range of podcasters, all the way from basic studio hire right through to full season production packages. You can get us on castawaycollingwood@gmail.com or just look up Castaway Studios on all the social medias.